So welcome today to Office Hour. This is Professor J, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz. And before we get started today, I'm very happy to announce that we now have a website set up with podcasts of all the old shows. So if you've missed any of the interviews or you missed part of interviews or you just want to listen to them again, and then you can just log on to Office Hour UCD Podcast. All is one long word, officehourucdpodcast.com. And you will find archived there all of our interviews from this fall's season. So I'm happy today. We're going to go, buckle your seatbelts, everybody out there, because we're going to go into an area which we have not yet done in Office Hour. Okay? We go out, we knock on someone's door at campus, trying to find out, what are all these people doing in all these offices here? What's happening in all these buildings? Well, today, we are knocking on the door of a scientist. So we're going to find out whether we can understand what scientists are doing, whether they can explain it to us and we can help everybody understand it. So, and today, I'm very pleased for our first foray into the world of hard science to have J. David Furlow, who I know well because he's also the director of the honors program at Davis. And if we have a chance, we'll talk a little bit about honors. But the main thing we're going to talk about today is frogs. Frogs and frog hormones. So, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks, Dr. J. It's very happy to be here.
Okay, so what we're going to do at the beginning, I always ask whoever we're interviewing to tell us a little bit about how you got interested in the field you got interested. Because we have people who come and are studying second century Rome, and you wonder, how did it come that someone wants to spend their life studying second century Rome? So here we have a question for you. How does it happen that someone wants to study frog hormones? What path led you to this? How'd you become a scientist?
Well, I do like second century Rome as well, but the reason that I got into essentially the larger field of biochemistry, for one thing, was that I was pretty good at most of my courses in high school. And my father, who was a historian, said, well, what do you like the best? And I said, well, I like biology and I like chemistry. And so he looked in the Penn State, I was thinking about going to Penn State, and he looked in the catalog and said, well, there's a major here that says biochemistry.
Ah.
And I said, okay, that sounds good. Let me try that.
Two for one.
Yeah, exactly. We got it all together. But I did find I was really fascinated by the chemistry of life, that you could at least explain some life processes by chemical reactions. And it could also be my grandfathers were essentially engineers. And so to me, kind of breaking things apart and putting them back together again, I can't do that with my car. But with a living cell, I can actually probably tell you a lot of the things that are happening. And that really, really started to fascinate me. I got my undergraduate degree in biochemistry. I started working in a lab as an undergraduate that was interested in how hormones were secreted when you put rats in space. And I thought that was kind of cool, right?
So I thought maybe you'd get to go sometime with
maybe,
the rat.
Right? I thought, okay, well, I was living vicariously through the rats, right? I thought, okay, if I'm floating around in space, I would also like to know what my hormones are doing. So we got to actually work with rats that had been up in the space shuttle. But then I started thinking about hormones in general, and really fascinated me as sort of someone who was interested in the chemistry of life, that there were these small molecules. They're not very complicated chemically. Some are more complicated than others, but they're really not that complex. And yet the effects that they have on cells and in tissues and organs, then whole systems are enormously complex, and they vary from, you know, across all the various taxa. I mean, plants have hormones as well. So anytime you've got two cells, right, they can talk to each other, and they use hormones to do so. And to me, that essentially information processing problem that a small, chemically simple molecule could be governing the death or the life or the growth or the differentiation and changing shape, cells start to move. that did actually start to fascinate me. And so my dad was right that I really should have been a biochemist. But I started to really refine what that meant. And it was really the biochemical actions of hormones. And then, so I got my PhD in biochemistry at Wisconsin, worked with a PhD advisor at a similar path. He actually had grown up on a dairy farm, and he was really interested in reproduction. And so he kind of came at it from somebody suggesting to him, well, if you're interested in reproduction, why don't you figure out how estrogen works? And so he started working on estrogen. He wasn't satisfied with just measuring levels of estrogen. He wanted to know actually how it worked. And so he discovered how it worked. And so I got my PhD working on estrogen. And then I essentially had two paths. One, I could really get into the almost physics, really trying to understand the three-dimensional shape of the protein that estrogen interacts with, the estrogen mm-hmm. receptor. And to be honest, even though I like to break things apart down into their component parts, that was not as interesting to me as understanding more the systemic actions of hormones.
How they work together in the circle of life.
Yeah, exactly, right? And so how you get different effects, the same molecule having not only just different effect in different organisms, but even within the same organism, how you can expose one cell to a hormone and one thing will happen, but the same cell and the same organism will have a completely opposite response. So I started to kind of dial it back out and think more about the biology mm-hmm. Of the system, the more in a more systems way. And got a postdoctoral fellowship with an individual who had really made his career studying how individual genes were turned on and off in early development. Figured he'd trained up enough folks. He was working in the frog system because you can get eggs all the time.
Right.
And so it was an easy system to study early development. Anyway, he figured he trained up enough folks working on that. So he wanted to study something that had always fascinated him, and that was metamorphosis. So how does a tadpole turn into a frog?
Right.
For him, it had always been a means to an end. I need to get an adult frog to get more eggs so I can study early development. around that time, people had known for about 100 years that thyroid extracts would cause metamorphosis, mm-hmm. Even before they knew what a thyroid hormone was. But no one had really done a deep dive into how the hormone actually works to cause the changes of metamorphosis. So this was a lab that I joined that was one of the top in the world in terms of isolating genes and studying how genes work. And so Donald Brown, my postdoc advisor, wanted to figure out how hormones cause genes to work, turn on and off. So that's sort of the path. There was always an interest in hormones, an interest in how chemicals induce biological phenomena, I guess. And that's how I got into it. And so it's been fascinating to me ever since.
So you talked about engineering relatives, your grandfather. So part of you was interested always in how things work,
mm-hmm.
right? But your particular level that you want to think at is way down into one of the really deep central questions. It seems to me that you've put yourself quite at the center of a lot of questions, which is a development. How do things turn into what they are? We all develop, we hope, right? Yep. We've all developed. And that's kind of definitional of all the things, the plants, animals, they go through these stages.
Yep.
So that's what we're going to try to talk about today, how things develop and change. How does that mm-hmm. basic circle of life get circling?
Mm-hmm.
And I was interested when I was reading over the materials that you gave me, so two of your articles, and then looking, I subscribe to science. So I like to look through it for areas that I'm back to my Bio 1 pre-med days when I was a freshman a long time ago.
Yep.
So I was looking through there and looking at other articles. And the whole history of the study of these hormones is extremely interesting. And I just want to make sure maybe we should start off by just defining for our everybody listening, what is a hormone exactly? We hear that a lot. Like we hear somebody's got too much hormones or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, or not
but
enough.
What would you say exactly in your simplest terms what a hormone is?
Uh-huh. Well, yeah. So it's different than you might have heard of neurotransmitters. You've heard of other kinds of chemical signaling molecules. I could have gone down that road too. Most of my department is in neurobiology, so they study those things. a hormone is a chemical that is secreted, produced by one cell, that goes into the bloodstream to go to a distant cell to cause some sort of biological effect. So that's the strict definition of a hormone.
It's like an email, cell sent from one cell to another.
Right. Except it really isn't a hormone unless the email gets opened, right? Because something secreted in the blood, nobody's home, it doesn't.
But it's something that includes a lot of these kinds of mysteries. It has to be sent off. It has to go somewhere. It has to be received. Mm-hmm. And it has an effect. And these are all complicated. At each level, mm-hmm. it's something that's complicated. Okay. So what I also found fascinating was that the thyroid hormone, which we'll technically call on this show TH, mm-hmm. was the first that developmental morphogene that was ever discovered. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. So what that means is that this particular thyroid hormone, in other words, the chemical messages that are emails that are sent off by your thyroid, were the first ones that were somewhat isolated and recognized as being developmental, having something to do with development.
Yeah. So let me just take one step back. Instead of email, that's a decent analogy, but it's actually a lot. Hormones are more like what we're doing right now, which is broadcasting.
Aha. Okay.
So we are casting our signal to the wind. Right, out in this ether, right? And then it's received, right? And there are specialized receivers that can sense that and interpret that signal. So, in fact, a hormone is not sent by email from the thyroid gland to your heart through a path. It's actually broadcast.
Through your whole body.
Through your whole body, right? And if there's not a receptor for thyroid hormone in your left toe, it just keeps on going, right? Anyway, so that was one thing.
Okay.
So I thought, keep it on the broadcast analogy.
Okay, that's good. That's useful.
Yeah.
Okay.
But as far as the effects on development, yeah, absolutely. I mean, when people think about hormones and they think about endocrinology, the first thing they think about, well, is two big things. One is reproduction, right? So people think about estrogens or androgens, testosterone and progesterone, right? These are things that obviously are on the forefront of lots of people's minds. Or they think about diabetes, right? They think about insulin. And in between those two big concepts where you have the governance and the regulation of reproductive processes to make an embryo, right? And then you have the adult that's got to maintain what we call homeostasis, right? Not too much, not too little. We want to keep our blood glucose kind of within a certain range for us to use it properly. In between those two states, those two biological states, there is this whole window, right, where we're elaborating from a fertilized egg through all of this,
That's where
this
we're
miracle
developing.
Of development, right? That this dance of cells that are finding their way and telling each other what to do and kind of
becoming a person.
And there's a lot of room in there where, in fact, hormones, once you develop a circulatory system, now you can start broadcasting these things, these hormones, right? And they can start to coordinate the maturation, mostly, of organ systems. So that all was a bit, and remains, I'd say, a bit understudied. But certainly once these horse parts, essentially, it's sort of the way they were discovered, the way thyroid hormone was discovered, there were horse parts that were essentially fed to tadpoles to see what would make them grow. They were just saying, okay, what's the nutritive value of horse muscle, horse thymus, horse thyroid? Ah, boom. That's the thing that actually made the legs grow and the tail shrunk, right? These are things that you could instruct, essentially, right? These things, these developmental processes to happen simply by putting it in the water. So, yeah, that was really the origins of being able to hone in on what was a particular molecule that we could study that was inducing these developmental processes pretty early on. Yeah.
So are you saying that this amazing discovery was partly based on luck?
Yeah.
I mean, that's really nice for us to hear, the humanities, that sometimes luck is a big factor.
Yeah.
That people were just trying a lot of different ways to try to see what would influence growth. And it turned out somebody tried the thyroid hormone, and that turned out to be really effective. So they said, ha ha, of all the messages that we've been sending, this one seems to be an important message.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
For what they were looking for. Yeah, right.
What they were looking for. Mm-hmm. So their story, we're going to take a short break now. We've finished our first segment today with Dave Furlow on frog hormones. So hang on. We'll be right back with our second section today, and we'll talk some more about how hormones work and what particular research he's been doing. So stay with us.
And they're life and death decisions, right? You have the growth of the limbs, but you have the death of the tail, right? So it's an extraordinarily comprehensively acting hormone in terms of the tadpole. In terms of humans and development, we have a little tail that does shrink a bit, but it's not thyroid hormone dependent, right? Our limbs are not thyroid hormone dependent in that regard. But our cerebellum is, so the part of our brain that helps us learn complex motor skills, walking, and our ability to converse right now and move fine movements of our mouth and everything, right? All those things are learned because of the actions of thyroid hormone on the cerebellum around birth. So it's pretty specific in terms of its developmental effects in humans. It's not as comprehensive, but it still plays that role. Conversely, in warm-blooded animals, thyroid hormone somehow evolved the ability to regulate our use of fuel and our body temperature. So folks out there that have had thyroid disorders as adults would certainly appreciate that. If they've had too much thyroid hormone, say Graves' disease, they will feel warm and restless and sweat a lot. Or if they don't have enough thyroid hormone, something called Hashimoto's thyroiditis, that's a very common autoimmune disease that has the opposite effect, not enough thyroid hormone, folks with that will feel cold, right? Mm-hmm. And that's not what a frog uses it for, right? So a frog doesn't, I'm embarrassed to say, actually, other than probably a role in reproduction, we don't know what thyroid hormone does in an adult frog. Uh-huh. It's certainly not regulating metabolism or, you know, and sort of body temperature.
So it's not doing what it does for humans, but it is a good thing to study, right?
Yes.
And the point is that you found something that has very targeted things you can understand about humans. Mm-hmm. And also it's way easier to study with frogs than with humans, right?
Yep.
So one of the advantages of frogs, from what I understood from the reading, is that they reproduce quickly. They have a short lifespan. They're fairly inexpensive. And I imagine that generally when the question of the use of lab animals, which you know is a very big issue, that frogs are not considered to be as important as maybe mammals are. I've always been struck by this kind of a mammal identification tendency, I think, among concern, and that amphibians, cockroaches, things like that, maybe not as much.
Well, yeah, one thing I can say is that our frogs are vertebrates, so they have a backbone. And so, in fact, they're governed by the same rules as studies using mice and rats, right? So all vertebrates come under the same purview of the federal government. And so if we have to apply to have an animal use protocol that's very carefully of, say, how many animals we use, if they're going to be in any distress, what are we going to do, how are we monitoring the health of our animals? And there are additional extra layers that are involved with rats and mice, and certainly primates are a whole nother thing.
Yes.
But I would say that, you know, the scrutiny, and rightly so, of our frog use and care is as high as mice and rats. So it's really when you get into invertebrates, rightly or wrongly, when you get into invertebrates like the cockroach or fruit flies, which is another very popular.
Worms, fruit flies, very popular.
Yeah, so those are not under the same regulations as a vertebrate would be. So so for us, it doesn't really, I guess, avoid those concerns. But what it does, though, is allow us to have access to developing embryos and tadpoles year-round, and thousands of them.
Thousands, right.
Right. So.
Okay, so now we've got it. You've got your protocol filled out. You've got your thousands of tadpoles.
Yep.
You understand that you've got this thyroid hormone, and you're looking at the question, and now we're going to get a little technical again, about RXRs, which are receptors. Mm-hmm. In other words, those are like our listeners. Those are the people out there that are hearing the broadcast.
Right.
And what's the relationship between us sitting here? We don't see the listeners. We don't know. We don't know much about them.
Right.
So you're also, one of the things you're doing is you're trying to understand the receptor end of the message.
Yep. And that's mostly what we do. So folks, you know, not too long after they discovered I can feed horse parts, thyroid glands to tadpoles, they pretty quickly they purified the hormone and they found out exactly what it is and they could measure it and that sort of thing. For me, the fascination really always has been on the receiving end, right? So how does a tail get the same exact signal and die, but the limb, the little pre-limbs essentially get the same exact signal and grow? And they're made of the same cell types. They've got their skin, there's nerves, there's muscle, right? So ultimately, that's at the receptor level, right? That's what we believe.
So let's just make sure we clarify that, because that's a really interesting point. What happens, we send our message out, and it's received in completely different ways everywhere where it's received. Something different happens at each place where the message arrives. The question then becomes, why? Why is it that this same hormone has so many different effects going through different parts?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now we've got our deep scientific question. So what's the answer?
Well, I wish I knew. So it's keeping us busy and funded, right, to go after that piece. Part of it is there are different kinds of receptors out there. And so currently we have two ways to approach this. We have a chemical approach, which is essentially to make designer hormones. So now we can actually make, so thyroid hormone itself, so there's two flavors of that, but the same one that's in a fish and you and I sitting here, that's received by all the receptors the same way. The receptors know what to do with that in specific ways, but the signal's exactly the same. But for us to essentially fool them, to trip certain pathways, to hit one receptor over another, we can exploit our understanding of the structure of those receptors. Now this is sort of getting into that business I thought about going into that I now rely on, which is to look at the three-dimensional models of these receptors. And I can work with my organic chemistry friends. I guess I was always a closet organic chemist. I always wanted to be an organic chemist. But they make me essentially designer hormones that can fit into these pockets in specific ways.
And why are you doing that?
So that way we can discern if we trip that receptor, what are the genes that it's regulating? What are the outcomes? What are the different processes that it's regulating? If I just throw thyroid hormone, everything happens, right?
Right.
If I add these designer hormones that we designed to trip one pathway, now we can start to sort of discern why only that pathway is regulated. What are the sets of genes that are under the control of one receptor versus another, that sort of thing.
And what you're saying is that it sounds to me like you've taken us back to your grandfather, that you're back in the world of engineering in a certain kind of way. So it always strikes for those of us on the outside that it's somewhat confusing as to what is the chicken and what is the egg in this. In other words, do you have to already understand something in order to make your special hormone? You also have to already have some kind of an understanding of what you're talking about, that you're saying shape, which I imagine is a teeny tiny little shape.
And then
you can show some kind of special use when you make something that then fits into that shape.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds a little bit like, how do you know what comes first? I mean, how did they, you know, this is mysterious. Since I have you here, I'm going to see if you can explain that to me, something I've often wanted to understand.
Yeah.
You know, what comes first in that theory? If I had an organic chemist here talking about that, would they maybe tell me a slightly different story about they do with you and how, you know, how they help people like you figure out what you need to do or something.
Sure. So it is always a reiterative process, though, I will say that, right? You always learn a little bit something, you're always making observations and predictions, testing hypotheses, following up, tweaking, testing again, refining. So it's always a reiterative process, and it's always built on things that people knew or they think they knew. Going in. So, you know, for me, when I look at a problem, I say, all right, well, I found out that this receptor, which is only slightly different, but different than the other receptor, is expressed, say, in the tail, right? And I know, and maybe it's expressed in parts of the intestine that shrink, and I know it's expressed in the gills that are going to shrink. That's interesting. So what is it? Can I exploit something about that difference to make a prediction that I can test? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, the organic chemists that do sort of applied work are of two flavors. One, they may work at a pharmaceutical company and say, okay, give me a problem. There's a cancer cell. Okay, I'm going to take, you know, 10,000 chemicals, a library, and throw them at the cancer cell and see what happens, right? And if they get a hit, then they refine it, right? Or there's essentially smart drug design, quote-unquote smart, because it doesn't always work out, but where you take the structure of your target. So somebody's got to actually go ahead and say, you know, purify it to some, you know, incredible degree and say, okay, I've got this pure protein that I know my hormone, the natural hormone, interacts with it. Now I've determined the three-dimensional shape, and now I'm going to try to, with my chemical bag of tricks, find something to wedge in there and trip only part of the structure, but not another, right? And sometimes they model that, so they don't know for sure if it will do that. So then you have to go back, right, and say, okay, did it trip it the way that we thought? So it is always built on some basis of knowledge, and then always reiterative.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that was actually a really beautiful description of how science works. So I want to say that I think that was very helpful in that it is somewhat mysterious, and you sort of articulated for us that you're always at the edge of your knowledge, mm-hmm. and you're always sort of guessing. Okay, I've tripped this thing is happening now that I've changed the hormone. Now I'm going to go back, and I'm going this kind of back and forth between. And sometimes you don't get what you want.
No, yeah, right.
Which is a very important point we've talked about before on this show, which is to say out loud to students that sometimes things don't work.
Absolutely.
And for a reason, that yep. failure is part of this back and forth,
yep.
trying to, then you go back to your friends and you say, well, this didn't quite work, and they try something else, and they come back to you, and that kind of experience going back and forth.
Right.
So, and
that's
then
right.
What you're looking for then is just for then us to bring it back a little bit towards how this then is going to help us understand things with humans. So I'm going to give you an example that I was reading about that I found fascinating. So let's see, go back and forth. The idea that they're finding frogs that have been feminized in certain water sources. And the question of whether or not there's something that's happening to them in the environment will then have an effect on this chemical message that's sent out.
Right.
The people, we may be in control of what we're saying, but there may be other things coming over the airwaves that we're not in control of that may also have effects. And only by doing the basic science to understand how the system works are we going to be able to figure that out.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So that whole world, essentially, you could make a strong argument that the world of endocrine disrupting chemicals is sort of the term that people use. That's interference out there between the signal or sending a false signal from another source. It's very interesting to me that it did grow straight out of basic science, which was there was a Lou Gillette at the University of Florida was a real expert in how how the sexes of alligators develop. And it was temperature dependent, which is kind of cool, right? So that's very interesting to me that there are many ways of making male and female biological sex, but, right, sometimes it's chromosomal, sometimes it's temperature, sometimes it's both, right? There are lots of different ways to do that. At the end of the day, you get roughly 50-50, and that's what matters, right?
Right.
Except for some lizards, right, that have all females,
right.
which is cool also. but basically, Gillette had studied that for a number of years, right? And so when he found out that in this lake, he was getting all either feminized males, right? Or the sex ratio was way off. There were hardly any males. He thought, well, what's going on? I wonder, because he knew that estrogen could play a dominant role in that species in terms of that development of either pathway. And so he started looking around and linked exactly when the population started to crash and started to, because that's going to crash your population too, right? That traced right to when there was a huge chemical dump. But it was DDT, right? And we were supposed to get rid of DDT because of Silent Spring, right? All of that. So boom, that's when it crashed. And they found out that there were chemicals at high concentrations, but nonetheless, that were in fact acting like estrogen. If it wasn't really for, my argument is, right, if it really wasn't for Gillette's deep understanding of comparative endocrinology, not necessarily applied, right, not clinical endocrinology, but this basic endocrinology and understanding the physiology of alligators, we might not have figured that out.
Mm-hmm.
So
what do you think the message is for in terms of humans on that, mm-hmm, which is mm-hmm, that one mm-hmm. of the messages is that, first of all, you want to be able to understand this better than you do now. Again,
yep.
So as exactly as you're saying, so you understand the basic workings of this chemistry. But you also think that there are other important messages for humans from that?
Yeah, well, certainly it raised the idea that there could be environmental chemicals right. that could be disrupting the endocrine system. And so I have been, it's been very interesting for me as a basic scientist studying how thyroid hormone works at a very fundamental level. I've been involved then in two different angles. One, I've been involved in clinical studies where we've developed designer drugs that affect the thyroid hormone system because, in fact, the receptors are extraordinarily well conserved between humans and frogs.
Right.
We designed the first hormone that would block by first principles. We said, okay, let's figure out on the structure how we can interfere with thyroid hormone action, because somebody that has the levels of thyroid hormone are way too high, maybe
right.
that would help them. So that was interesting to me because I hadn't really really sought that out. I kind of got into that. And then the other thing was that I had European investigators and eventually U.S. folks from the EPA come to me and say, hey, these guys are swimming around in water. Thyroid hormone hasn't been investigated yet in terms of chemicals like this. Could we collaborate with you to develop assays to really sort out if there are, in fact, chemicals out there like the DDT story and the alligators? Are there things that could be interfering with thyroid hormone action? Because we know the receptors are conserved. We know the molecule is exactly the same between frogs and humans.
Right.
What they do is some things are the same. Some things are very dramatically different. But nevertheless, the nuts and bolts are the same. And so maybe we can use the system to sort that out. So, there definitely have been not – I've had my eyes open to it. I've certainly gotten a lot of funding from those angles that has kept the lab moving along and continuing to discover basic things about thyroid hormone action. But, yeah, I mean, both of those applications to the human condition have been interesting to me. And we've definitely pursued those things.
And they're important, right?
Well, yeah, sure.
It turns out that all those crocodiles are going one way, that it may be a warning for us as humans to think about it as well.
Yeah.
So, terrific. Well, we have actually finished our second segment.
Okay.
So we're going to take our a quick break for a public service announcement, and then we're going to come back and clarify any other questions that, any ideas of the future of frog hormones. So stay with us. So, welcome back to the third and final segment of Office Hour today. Professor Jay talking with David Furlow. And we've clarified the importance of the study of frog hormones with the idea that it's going to give us basic science that helps us understand frogs, but also helps us understand humans as well. And the incredible power of hormones, the capacity for outside interference in hormones, the need to understand how to regulate them. And how frogs are sort of like the royal road. They're like the super path. They're the super pathway to understanding this all. And I want to talk a little bit now, a little bit more broadly, because I think it's a very important time in American society right now for the role of the scientist. And we are a public university.
Yep.
And so we are also involved in the question. I was quite struck by the Science magazine, which I've subscribed to for a long time, being full of more what we would call sort of political articles than I'd ever seen before, asking scientists to get out of the labs. Mm-hmm. I know that I saw a sign at a protest I was at. It said, you know, it's really bad when scientists get out of their labs. So, I was wondering your thoughts about that. What do you think? I mean, it's very many different questions all wrapped up in one. But one is the capacity we have to actually educate people about science. How do we get it so people can understand what you do,
yeah,
and how we're not, don't seem to be doing a very good job of it right now?
Yeah, I think that's a terrific point. And it's certainly been a real increasing trend, not just recently, but it's been evolving and it just sort of accelerated now in terms of scientists being asked to step up both in articulation and communication of their science and the value of science and what they're finding to the general public, to have a more scientifically literate society, but also in terms of politics now, right? And, you know, I was sort of disturbed to see recently that references at the Centers for Disease Control to take out the word science-based and evidence-based. I mean, that is, that's a research-oriented, public-facing, public service arm of the federal government that has always been anchored in science to try to eradicate HIV. There was an interesting role for the CDC and interface between science and politics there for sure. But Zika virus, all these things, right? These are not just sort of, I think Zika is bad, or maybe it's bad, maybe it's not. I mean, there's evidence-based and science-based ways that we can track and potentially eradicate these diseases. So, I do consult for the Environmental Protection Agency, and the same sorts of things are happening there in terms of the ways that scientists are allowed to talk about their work. That is really kind of disturbing to me. So I do think it's extraordinarily important for scientists to get out of their lab, to come on radio shows, to try to explain why we do what we do, the importance of what we do, to engage our friends in the humanities, to engage our friends and our politicians, to engage folks about the nature of science and the role of science in society. Because there's just, it's a very complicated world, and to sort of shut that down is not being part of the inquiry process of an inquiring mind, a critical mind, I think is not a great path for our society.
Well, how do you think we're doing? I mean, how do you think we're doing at science literacy? How do you think we're doing? We can talk globally. We can talk America. We can talk about it at our campus. I mean, I think these are complicated, but they're worthwhile taking a little bit of the show to consider that. How are we doing with science literacy, do you think?
Well, you know, I see a lot of my colleagues, and I've done some of this myself, going to elementary schools. They tend to be pretty receptive audiences. They're pretty excited about tadpoles, for sure, right?
Yeah.
So, ooh, wow, that's really interesting. But then I see things, you know, my daughter, when she was in elementary school, she was very good at science. And then something happened in junior high where she didn't really want anything to do with it. It wasn't cool. It wasn't something she was interested in. So I seem to think there were a lot of pressures there in terms of women in STEM education that are interesting to me and potentially a problem societally. But I think there's a disconnect there between an early interest and fascination. There's an inherent fascination, I think, in children of elementary school age. And then there's some shift there where it's either deemed it's too hard or it's not interesting enough or something like this, where I think we have to work a little bit harder. So I think part of it is us getting out of the lab, but it's sort of like this receptor problem out there, right?
Back to the hormones.
Back to the hormones, that there has to be a receptive audience too. Mm-hmm. Right. And mm-hmm. So people have to be willing to listen. I also am concerned this sort of fractionation of where people get information, that it's hard to break through as well. Right. So if people aren't interested in hearing about evidence-based or science-based approaches and they turn that off, how do we get around that? So I think scientists are willing to get out there. But how do you get then the general or the populace that you're trying to reach to at least listen? I don't think that's a science only thing. I think that's a general societal thing.
Mm-hmm. But it's up to you guys to find the hormone. You have to find you have to find the science interesting hormone. So
yeah.
I think that point is very, very well taken. It's the same thing with something like poetry that, we think everybody when they're a child likes to write poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And then something happens with an inhibition around curiosity about words and things like that happen. Yeah. So, and what you're saying is that you bemoan the fact that the same thing happens in the field of sciences as well.
Yeah.
That people lose a certain kind of curiosity. So, okay, so what do you think would make, you know, if you could wave your magic wand, how do we make people curious? How do we make the listeners curious?
Yeah.
Let's say, how do we get them curious about science?
Well, so I think it probably does go to exposing one way or another, and don't put too much pressure on our K through 12 system because they have a lot of pressures funding wise and things. But I really do think the way science is traditionally taught, sort of memorizing facts and this was discovered on this date and that sort of thing, there's some reason to do that. I my father's a historian. I like the history of science. But to me, it's how do you maintain a sense of curiosity and fascination about the world? And I mean that by expressing through poetry. I mean that by just asking questions, making observations about the world, and just being curious. And so are there ways to reward that, to embed that in our educational process all the way through, right? That it's not the sort of field trip, right? That's somehow built all the way through. And that's a challenge we have at the university.
Yes. Right. I was thinking that even as you were talking.
Yeah, right. So we're not immune to that. That's why I didn't want to put it all in K through 12, because we're looking at things, say, the first year seminar program, where I've talked to some of my colleagues about, you know, wonder seminars, right? Just curiosity, right? Just follow your nose. Have a seminar where a biologist, someone would bring in their tadpoles and say, I'm not sure what's going to happen here, but this is pretty cool. Ask a question. Look at that tadpole turning into a frog and just ask a question. And instead of me standing up there with PowerPoint saying, here's a tadpole, here's a frog, I know thyroid hormone does this and thyroid hormone does that, challenge students all the way through, from K through whatever, to ask questions, make observations, and just really be curious of the world at every turn, every way we can do that, instead of just sort of all the time pouring on facts.
Mm-hmm. Well, we had a show on which I talked about some of my ideas about what does it mean to be an educated person. Mm-hmm. And I must admit that I didn't cover science, so I feel very negligent because of that. And maybe we can make up for it today. So let's say so one of our listeners is interested and they're not necessarily enrolled now in a science class.
Yeah.
And they have a sense of wonder and a sense of interest, or they, that, you know, how do you, would you go about encouraging them? I'll tell you one of the things that I find, which is that a lot of the science that's presented to me, even as somebody who was once in Bio One, is difficult to follow. You know, I do subscribe to Science Magazine and I will flip through it, but there's a lot of articles.
Well, there's a lot of articles that, for me, too, when we get into the deep space stuff. Fascinating, though.
It is fascinating. And, I study placebo. So when I see anything about that, I print that out and read that and look that over. I took pharmacology classes, psychopharmacology, at an upper level as an undergraduate. So I follow things like that. But for everybody else, how do they, let's say they're interested in the frog hormones that we've talked about today, and they're interested in that. You know, how is science become accessible to what I call an educated adult?
Sure.
So that's
sure.
someone who knows their way around this, but may not necessarily know a great deal about frog hormones or ever thought about it until today's show.
Right. If it's a very specialized topic, that can be tricky, right? I would say that I think publications like Scientific American or the New York Times science section, right? There are places that I find pretty reliable and accessible. I do agree, if you just pick up science and you say, oh, I see, there's something about thyroid hormone and its receptors and turning this gene, you can get lost pretty fast. So that's true. So I think that one thing I've thought about, we have about, I don't know, 2,000, something like this, biological sciences majors at on our campus.
Okay.
And more than that in the biological sciences overall, right? And my major and things like this, more specialized majors. But we have a lot of students who kind of pick biology because they're interested in it, or their parents say they should study biology or something like this. But I think that there should be an emphasis, and there should be a way to do this where we encourage a group of those students to build on their natural curiosity and facility with biology to turn into great writers and communicators. I think that should be a major or it should be a minor or something like this, right? Science communication, it's often just teaching, right? Sort of, and I don't want to say just teaching. That was not the right thing to say, because I have lots of biology educators in my family. But I guess science communication and mm-hmm. educating the public, that I think there is a gap there. I think there's a real opportunity in physics, in chemistry, across the natural sciences, to do that. So it's partly on us to do that better.
Well, that's exactly what we've been talking about. That yeah. is the hormone, right? Yeah. That what you're saying is the broadcasting that's going on by mm-hmm. science mm-hmm. isn't everything it needs to be in right. order to be received by the audience.
Yeah,
sometimes it isn't really clear enough, and that one of the things that we need to do. So you heard it first here today. Okay. The idea, we're now launching a new science communication project for the yeah. University of California, Davis, to clarify to people what's going on in the world of science, and yep. maybe drawing upon undergraduates, because they're right there. They're the people that are understanding, they're developing the deeper understanding, yep. but they're still in touch with themselves as the people who haven't yet become the people who are so far off in their labs that they can only communicate to the one other person in the world who is studies the same thing.
Right.
So I think that's really a wonderful idea, and I'm very happy to have that launched as part of our broadcast today. Mm-hmm. I think the last thing I wanted to have a few minutes to talk about was the honors program.
Yeah, sure.
Because I know you run it, and I know a lot of people are not even aware that we have an honors program at Davis.
Right, right.
So the first thing we want to do in our broadcast is just say that we have yeah, an honors program
do.
At Davis, and
yep.
I've been involved in it for many years, and I think there are many wonderful things about it. And I think it's a question for you is, what do you really see as the role of honors here as the honors director?
Yeah.
What does that add to our rich intellectual community?
Yeah. Well, part of it goes directly to what we were just talking about, right? So for me, it's encouraging students who want to move beyond their individual majors and become leaders and communicators and build bridges across disciplines. To me, it's inspiring a group of students who they've been academically high achieving. There is a role for essentially recruitment, right, of great students to the Davis campus that's a part of this. But to me, it's not necessarily about a pat on the back or, hey, you did great, and, you know, we want to give you priority registration or something like this. What we'd like to do in our honors program, what I think we're doing, is encouraging students to be big thinkers and to work across majors. We have a great living learning community where we have an intentional mix of engineers, biologists, philosophers, right? So there's a real great mix of students who are academically very good, but they are mixing together to challenge each other and challenge in interesting classes as well. So that's a lot of what we have the honors program for, I think, is to stimulate these students to think critically, think beyond their individual majors.
Mm-hmm. So would you say it's similar to honors programs at other campuses?
There's a lot of variation out there. It's interesting to me that you will see an honors program at a liberal arts college, because a lot of the things that we're trying to do, which is have a small class, have a liberal arts education, be able to write and think, and right? There's something that the liberal arts college may already be doing because they don't have the 500 seat classes, right? So I would say the Davis Honors Program is a little unique in the sense that we really try to work hard to achieve balance by major that's reflective of the campus and also reflective demographically. We're pretty proud of the fact that our honors program is very reflective of the Davis undergraduate population as a whole. We've got roughly the amount of engineers that are here. We also have the roughly the amount of Latinx and Chicanx students that are on campus, you know. And so I think it's that mix of this wonderful state that we live in, the wonderful mix of majors, the breadth that's on this campus. I think we're unique in the fact that we're intentionally and intensively reflective of our undergraduate population.
Mm-hmm. So if one of the messages we're taking away is the importance to train our students to communicate what science is because mm-hmm. of the failure of many people to understand it, and
yeah.
that then maybe the second other major point, which you could address a little bit, is you did mention the liberal arts. And
yep.
I'm curious for you as a scientist.
Yep.
We traced your life path today, and there wasn't mm-hmm. a lot of liberal arts in there.
No.
But yet you believe that an honors program, getting students to think a little more broadly, is based in part on having a liberal arts kind of an education. So I'd be curious as to what you think is the value of a liberal arts education in the world we're in today. Because you're a little bit swimming upstream against a lot of forces that are trying to make undergraduate education as pre-professional as possible. Uh-huh. Forces even on our own campus.
Yep. So what I did mention was I was an honors student at Penn State, big, research-oriented, research-one institution. Got into a lab second day of my time on campus, fell in love with that. My favorite courses were my honors courses in philosophy and political science. So by far, right? I mean, I certainly enjoyed learning how genes were turned on and off and things at the level we knew at that time. Sure. I think the pre-meds, the self-declared pre-meds, because we don't really have a pre-med track at Davis, but the self-described pre-meds here are a lot more interesting than they were in the mid-80s at Penn State. They were real grinders and real... I was certainly attracted to understanding questions from a lot of different perspectives.
Yeah.
Right. I was utterly convinced that I did not have the tools to either understand what I'm... even if I had, you know... acing calculus, fine, but I was utterly convinced I didn't have the tools to ask the right questions, to articulate them, to write about them, to communicate them properly, if I was not broadly trained and broadly exposed to a lot of different ideas. It may be that my father was a historian, my mother got her degrees in English literature, that I had that appreciation, I suppose, but that was very important from early on. I am also equally convinced that whether you're talking about endocrine disrupting chemicals, or you're talking about, what do we do with North Korea? You're talking about all these, this is not, one person knowing how to solve everything, right? This has to be a collaborative effort of folks with all kinds of different backgrounds and perspectives to solve these problems. I mean, it sounds cliched and it can sound cliched, right? But, you know, when you believe it and you've seen it in action, it isn't.
Mm-hmm. So what you're saying is that you did get something in your undergraduate days out of non-science classes, in case there's any science majors out there listening.
Clearly.
Right there. And that is part of being able to be the kind of scientist you want to be. Was your classes you took in philosophy and your classes you took in political science.
Absolutely.
And then that was important to you. And therefore, we got to encourage the science students to get out there and ask those big questions. Sometimes I think they feel, as you were saying, ill-equipped for asking questions that may be more open-ended than they're used to, maybe less clear about getting the results.
Right.
But that somehow that was useful for your training in science.
Yeah, so there's two parts to that. One, it's you could take that tack and say, yeah, it may be the scientist and the and then an academician, right, that I am today. On the other hand, I hope try to be a more interesting person, right?
Okay.
I try to be a better informed citizen, right? I try to do. It's certainly enriched my life in ways that if may not have been otherwise, right?
Okay. Well, I think That's a very good point. I think that's a wonderful point about being a more interesting person and a more enriched person and well-rounded citizen.
Yep.
I think that's a great point to end on. And if people are interested in your articles, we always remind everybody that I'm sure you have a website.
I do.
Dave Furlow, and that students will and listeners and adults and whoever's interested in reading more about frog hormones can log on and find some of your material there and can get in touch with you if they have particular questions. And we really want to thank you for coming around today and leading us into the world far from where we've been on our first shows. And thank you for coming. And our listeners will be back next week with a completely different office. We'll knock on a different door. So please join us next week. And that's it for today for Office Hour.